Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome to another episode of Sea Dreams, the podcast exploring Southeast Asia and why it's the region to watch for in the next decade. I'm Kenneth Nguyen. I'm joined by my co-hosts, An Vo and Phil Van. And in this episode, we're going to discuss the recent 5-3 win on aggregate by Vietnam over longtime rivals, Thailand, in the 2024 ASEAN Mitsubishi Electric Cup of Soccer, or football, in early January 2025. And we'll be discussing the significance of that win and the history of football in the region and the participation of the region in the World Cup and how football may improve in the future for the region. Let's dig into it.
Southeast Asia's soccer scene is seeing a pretty remarkable transformation, a stark contrast to its less illustrious past. Historically, before the turn of the millennium, the region's soccer standards lagged significantly behind, with underfunded leagues and limited access to quality coaching. But today, countries like Thailand, Vietnam, and Indonesia are injecting new life into the sport with substantial investments in coaching expertise and player recruitment. And the shift is nurturing local talent in ways that have never been seen before. The ASEAN Mitsubishi Electric Cup, which stokes regional pride, along with increased funding for modern training facilities and youth programs, is propelling Southeast Asia into a new era as an emerging power in the international soccer landscape.
But An, what does all of that even mean to the region, to Southeast Asia?
I think you can say that sports has always been political, right? For example, was it the 1936 Berlin Olympics was a platform for the Nazis to showcase the success of the Nazi regime. Whenever a team in the US, Seattle or Chicago win a national championship, it's a cause of celebration within that city, a cause of pride, and economically it spurs a lot of interest and spending in that particular region. So it's no wonder that when Vietnam won the ASEAN Mitsubishi Electric Cup earlier this year, January 2025, for the 2024 version of the cup, it sparked a huge celebration in Vietnam, right? Soccer is the number one sport in Vietnam and for almost all of it, Southeast Asia, except for the Philippines where it's basketball. But for Southeast Asia and Asia in particular, I mean, more generally, soccer is the number one sport, not only in this region, but in almost all around the world, except for the US and maybe Canada. But in terms of participation, soccer is the number one.
You know, why didn't it ever catch, why didn't it catch up, take off here in America?
That's a good question. You could also argue why the decimal system didn't really catch. No one knows.
I think, it's popular on like an AYSO level, like a kid.
Yeah, it's the number one participation sport for kids.
Yeah. So my son loves it. It's the only sport he wants to keep playing. And I think all his friends would agree. I think also international stars like, Ronaldo or Messi are actually transcending barriers and are really popular with even American kids.
Yeah.
And adults alike. But I think it's competing franchises. I think there are too many American sports that are heavily guarded like as capitalist enterprises that actually prevent soccer from getting a foothold as a major sort of industry here.
Well, I think there's also demographic change too. So the MLS, Major League Soccer, was really big in the 1970s, when Pelé, world-renowned player, towards the end of his career, went to the New York City Cosmos, essentially, and sparked a lot of interest. And then during the 80s and 90s, In particular, you know, American football and the NFL and the NBL with the Chicago Bulls and Michael Jordan really, really pushed the those kind of sports. Baseball has always been like the traditional American sport, if you will. So they've always been there. But I think since the USA 94, the World Cup of 1994, I think, when the USA hosted it, they use that, or American soccer use that as a platform to really set up a professional league in America and also really establish a grassroots organization to develop youth players. And in the, 30 years since that time, professional soccer in the US has really grown in spits and spats, essentially. But if you look at the world club rankings, the value of clubs in the world, there are a smattering of American clubs in that in those rankings, which is unusual. Because if you talk to almost any football fan outside of the US, they can name off the top of their head 10, 20 clubs, and none of them will be American clubs.
Yeah. Well, why is it so important that Southeast Asia has its own sort of like conference or league or competitive series?
Well, the globally speaking, FIFA, the Federation Internationale of Football Associations, controls football at probably a national level, but also sort of at the club level too. And so FIFA splits all the countries of the world into several conferences.
Oh.
So there's a conference for Asia, AFC, and that spans anywhere from the Middle East to East Asia, i.e. China, and includes Southeast Asia. So it's a huge geographical expanse, right? Then they have African conference, North American, Central American, Caribbean conferences, South America, and the big kahuna is Europe.
So this last Thailand-Vietnam match, what is that in the sort
of... So the Southeast Asian countries have their own, have set up their own essentially conference within a conference. So they've set up the ASEAN Southeast Asian conference within the AFC, which is the Asian Football Confederation.
That falls under FIFA?
That falls under FIFA.
Okay.
And so, you know, so for example, like China, Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, etc., would want to compete against neighboring countries, right? They don't want to, and they would, because, you know, culturally we're very similar in Southeast Asia, right? But there's also the AFC, the Asian Federation, Confederation, where it includes China, it includes South Korea, North Korea, Dubai, you know, Saudi Arabia, etc. And so it's like, well, we also compete in that, or Vietnam, Thailand, etc. also compete in that, but we want to do one for Southeast Asia. So that's what the Mitsubishi Electric Cup is. You know, for those who are unaware, the Mitsubishi Electric Cup has other names, most notably the Tiger Cup and or the Tiger Beer Cup. And people from Vietnam and Thailand would recognize that because that's a very popular brand of beer.
Yeah.
Day,
yeah.
Even now.
There are a couple of really interesting, almost like paradoxes about the sudden sort of success. And that's that like soccer's huge in Southeast Asia, right?
Yeah. In terms of participation and probably in terms of like casual kind of interest. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's fairly recent that there's been any team that's good. So there's been a big disparity between like a professional soccer team and the massive level of interest like on the ground for the sport.
Yeah, I mean, I think
taxes was taxing. Now taxes is relaxing when you file for free.
I can file for free? TurboTax Free Edition. Roughly 37% of filers qualify. Simple form 1040 returns only. See if you qualify at turbotax.com/free. I can file for free.
Now this is taxes. File for free with TurboTax Free Edition and get your maximum refund. No schedules except for earned income tax credit, child tax credit, and student loan interest. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free.
As with most countries under FIFA, a lot of countries, or many countries, have their own professional soccer leagues or football leagues. The the extent and the value of those individual clubs and leagues varies quite significantly. Within the Southeast Asia region, scoping wider to the Asia Confederation, and even wider still as between different conferences and confederations. Professionalization, having professional clubs, professional leagues, is like a stepping stone to making the national team a lot more higher quality, if you will, and more competitive globally.
What does it do for a country in Southeast Asia when it wins, or a country in any country when their team wins?
Well, I think the U.S. is a very interesting kind of anomaly, I think, in a lot of this stuff. So from my perspective as an outsider, the American sports kind of culture is very inward-looking, right? You have the World Series played by teams from...
Yeah, and that's not really the world, right?
On the world.
Why would they call it the World
Series? Because it's named after a newspaper, essentially. The World newspaper. Who sponsored the original competition. But you have the NFL, which is essentially a North an American kind of thing. And apart from things like the Olympics, America doesn't really compete kind of internationally, if you will, right?
Yeah.
On a really large scale. But for the rest of the world, the two biggest competitions in sports is the Olympics, right? And the World Cup of football.
Yeah.
Those are the two big ones. And they happen every 4 years, staggered. So those are the two big ones. And they capture the world's imagination, right? The World Club Football, FIFA World Cup garners like 6 billion, 5 billion, 6 billion viewership each iteration.
I'm still so perplexed, like the Desmo system, why America is so out of the loop with, countries like Southeast Asia.
The Desmo system, I think I heard somewhere that America was meant to adopt the decimal system back in the day, like in the 1700s or late 1700s, I think, or what it was. And apparently the measures, the official measures for decimals, like weight and length, etc., was on a ship bound to the US, but that ship sunk. And so because those official measures didn't land in the US, the US basically continued with the imperial system.
So what
three countries in the world that continued with the imperial system.
So what is the analogy for that in soccer as it relates to Southeast Asia and the rest of the world, and why Southeast Asia picked up on it?
Well, I think one of colonialism. So the British and the Dutch were very big into soccer, of course, as is always the case. So there's that. I think America prides itself on being American and not a former British colony. So it kind of had its own homegrown sports, essentially.
Yeah. And the reason I ask these questions is when I think about Vietnam's recent win and I think about the crowds of people in the streets of Ho Chi Minh City, Saigon, and then I think about us here at home watching those games, it's such a disconnect for me.
Well, if you think about it, like, how often are Vietnamese people or Thai people or South Asian people able to compete, I think, physically in any sport?
Yeah.
Right? So you need to figure out a sport where we have a physical advantage, right? So basketball is not one where a Vietnamese or a Thai person who averages, 1.60 meters, 5'3", 5'4", right? Would be able to compete. Volleyball, for example, we don't really compete in that either, right? So you need to find sports where the physical attributes lend itself to some kind of competitive advantage. And in sports where it requires a lot of quick turns and where height is not really that part of the usual play, those sports are good. So that's why I think it explains why... that part, and the also part that soccer or football doesn't require much to play when you're a kid. It requires something that resembles a soccer ball. It doesn't really require a soccer ball. know, out in Africa, out in the favelas. It could be just a rolled up piece of newspaper, you know, wrapped in some tape. Right, and that will suffice to be a football for those who can't afford an actual football. And that's all you need to play football. If you think about volleyball, you need a net. You need if you talk about basketball, you need a backboard and stuff like that. If you look at fencing, you require all this gear to do fencing. If you talk about swimming, right?
You need pools.
You need pools, right? And so that explains why football is so popular around the world. It's because you don't need much to play. And two, good players can either be short or they can be tall. They can be scrawny or they can be muscled. Right, so it engenders a much more even playing field than many other sports.
Yeah.
Do you think Vietnam's going to make it to the World Cup?
In whose lifetime?
I don't know.
Wow, really? It's like that far off?
Yeah.
Why? Why is it that you just said that the physical disadvantages of people in Southeast Asia is basically a moot point. We don't really have to worry about it. But then now you're saying that this won't be in our lifetime.
Well, I think culture explains a lot of it. And in particular, it's sports culture, right? So I'll give you an example. In the favelas of Brazil, right? Soccer is seen as a golden key, a golden ticket to get out of poverty, right? And so soccer is played year-round, essentially. It's played by almost every kid after school, during school, before school, right? And if this kid has talent, then they're snatched up by the local club. And from the age of, what, 5, 6? And they go through the club system where the club basically pays their room and board, blah, blah, blah. And they develop that child to skill them up in soccer. Sometimes at the better run clubs, they also school them as well, put them through school as well. And so there's this infrastructure and culture there where, hey, soccer or football is seen as a way out of poverty, right? And there's an infrastructure there through the club system that will allow that child, if they have enough talent, to rise through and either play domestically within this country, or they'll be sold to other clubs in other countries and earn money that way. There's the same passion in Southeast Asia, right? But I don't think in Southeast Asia there's the same level of, hey, football is a viable way for me to get out of poverty, right? One, so that's the attitudinal problem. And the other one is that there's, at this point in time, I don't think there's enough infrastructure there to support that kind of desire.
Yeah.
And you can see that in the total number of clubs, the total number of divisions of professional football, and you also see that in the value of the clubs and the value of the players, from each nation or from each region.
I'm just curious as to why Southeast Asian soccer in Vietnam, but also in the entire ASEAN soccer league, has come up and become better in the last like 10 to 20 years. Like why has it suddenly ramped up? What was keeping it down before? What's changed that's allowed Southeast Asian soccer to flourish in a way that it was incapable of in previous generations?
Well, I think it's a great question, and I think the answer really can be answered in the mid-1990s with the introduction of the English Premier League, of all things. And what this was during the 93-94 season, the English Premier League came into existence. Previously, it was called the English First Division. But what the English FA, Football Association, which is a governing body of football in the UK, so decided, hey, we're going to repackage this, and we're going to run it essentially as a media commodity, right? So they took a very American sports kind of league-based approach to managing, marketing, and running football, right? So that happened in 1993, 1994. And then Other leagues around Europe did the same thing. So the Spanish rebranded itself into La Liga.
So, I mean, I'm going to fast forward. So basically, Asian countries did the same thing.
Yeah, so I think my response is the answer, true answer, is that sports, and in particular football, became very corporatized since the early 2000s, essentially, right? So clubs and the management of these clubs recognized that there was a lot of money to be made if it was repackaged and sold in a very media-friendly way, right? So you then you have things like clubs being listed on stock exchanges and being publicly traded companies rather than being run as clubs.
All right, so clubs. All that being said, you just gave us the backdrop of what they did in Europe. But why do you say that this will never pop off for Vietnam in our lifetime? Well,
So I think Vietnam and Thailand and a lot of Southeast Asian leagues, but Thailand and Vietnam in particular, have started corporatizing their sports leagues, in particular the football leagues, right? I think that's one way to look at it, right? Is that means that because it's a much more a media friendly kind of product, that encourages more sponsorship, so more money's coming in. More money's coming in, more demands are made on return on that product, right? So that means more professional management of clubs, for example. That means more spending on infrastructure of clubs to develop youth players. That means seeking out talent from overseas to come play within Vietnam, to come play within Thailand.
Okay, so why does that prevent Vietnam? Why is it... You just listed off a bunch of things that talks about the improvement of that ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So why can't Vietnam ever get to the World Cup or win the World Cup?
So there are several factors. So you can look at the management of soccer from an organizational level, right, within the country or within the region, right? Arguably, there's a lot of corruption, perhaps, or mismanagement, if you will, within sports leagues or within the conferences, right? There's a lack of investment in the infrastructure and youth development, for example, right? There's also competition, right, for a limited number of dollars, right? So if you're a potential sponsor, do you sponsor a Vietnamese team? Or do you sponsor, a European team, for example, right?
So wait, all of this has nothing to do, it's a funny question, about the genetics of the players.
Well, no. So you can look at, let's say, the South American teams like Argentina, right? Their players tend to be very similar in height to us, 160, 170 centimeters.
Small guys,
right?
Because Messi is an Argentinian player, right?
Yeah, he's 160.
He's tiny.
He's
168. Yeah, when you look at him on the field, he's
not tiny. Some of us are 168 or perhaps a little bit taller than that, Ken. Not all of us can be 6 foot. So, yes, so Messi is around 168, which is 5'6".
Yeah.
Right. And in soccer, when you do quick turns and whatnot and short-term sprinting, that's not a disadvantage. It's actually an advantage.
Yeah.
Because it's low center of gravity.
So wait, so you're saying that it's just really a matter of the things that you said earlier, which is bribery, there's corruption, there's mismanagement of money.
Sports culture is a big thing, right? So is soccer or football seen as a way out of poverty?
Okay, so that's one of the big reasons, right?
I think that's one of the big reasons, cool. Right?
Cool.
In South America, in Africa, if you're great at football, you can get scouted and pulled into a club and develop, right? I don't think the same thing happens to the same extent
in Southeast Asia. I get it now. Southeast Asian parents are probably really not thinking that they want their kids in some temporary superstar soccer position. Yeah. They want their kid to become a scientist, educated. And so therefore, they won't sink the money into dreaming of having their kid leave poverty.
Because the club development, the youth development, isn't as well established in Southeast Asia, for example. It's starting to be, but not as much as in, let's say, South America or Africa. So in South America, you have clubs. There are so many clubs, right? And they exist throughout various divisions, right? So in America, you basically have just the NFL, for example, and the NBA. You may have the XFL is one layer town, but apart from that, there's not that many professional clubs. In Europe, for example, and in South America, there's professional clubs, semi-professional clubs, and amateur clubs. And so each of those may have several divisions within it. So, for example, in the English league, professional leagues, there might be 8 divisions of teams.
Wow.
Each division is kind of like, 20 teams?
You know, it goes back to that priority of Southeast Asian parents. We want our kids to be educated. We don't want them to do anything that's risky. And I think becoming a soccer or a musician is the same thing. It's a 1 in a million chance of you becoming a superstar. But I think the reality in Europe is like there are systems and modes of training that'll get you or get you very close to the bottom 8, 7, 6, 5, whatever that division of that league would be, right?
And you can make a good living.
You can make
playing
a decent,
like the 8th division.
Right.
Right? You can make a decent living. But I think in Southeast Asia, that's not the case in the professional sports leagues.
Yeah.
Right.
So it makes sense. So when somebody like you says a comment like, not in our lifetime, right? It makes sense. It perfectly illuminates this idea of each country's priority. And when I think of American priorities, when I think of Southeast Asian priorities, European priorities, it really depends on the way the parents are thinking about success and the amount of infrastructure governments put into the systems to create these like situations.
It's interesting though, because if soccer is so beloved across Southeast Asian countries, like why wouldn't it be more supported on like a business, financial, industrial level, like as an actual enterprise and a track you can apply yourself to?
I think the answer
to succeed
is because the media game in Southeast Asia is not as strong as Western countries yet. I think so.
Well, which is kind of interesting because Southeast Asia has about 700 million people.
Yeah.
Right? But the purchasing power of that 700 million people is not as much as, let's say, the 300 million or whatever people in Europe.
Because they're just now learning that branding is the almighty God.
Yeah, it's
corporatization
of sports.
Yeah. Right. And Vietnam is just coming out of wherever, right? It's coming out of this war and it is now beginning to learn how to brand. But the talent has not caught up with the branding yet. So the branding is like a little bit ahead of the talent. The talent is like learning how to act, learning how to sing, learning how to do soccer, football. Yeah.
I mean, I think only in the last, 20, 30 years have foreign coaches and players have started permeating the Southeast Asian kind of football scene, right? Coaches from South America or coaches from Europe who've had decades and generations worth of growing up in that environment have come out and say, hey, we're here, we can help you.
I have a friend who's an Argentinian and went to Cambodia to be their head coach of the national team.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a real thing.
Yeah. And hopefully we'll see more of that, and then hopefully we'll see the reverse of that. You know, Southeast Asian players going to Europe, going to South America to ply their trade, and learning how to play in the South American system or the European system, etc.
This
and hopefully coming back and then helping the grassroots development of the.
I think this is why podcasting is so important. I grew up thinking that. I mean, I was such naive thinking that it was always genetics, that we couldn't compete with Europe or America in sports. But it's not at all. It's we don't have branding and media understood. We therefore don't have talent, infrastructure, and money that supports the two things. And I think American sports understood very early on with the university football teams, college football, and then to pro football, and then the media, the power of TV in the 50s and 60s here, two things were growing concurrently. The talent, the media. Talent, media. Talent, media brings money. And when you have a lot of money, you can grow these things. So Vietnam or Southeast Asia, it's still developing these things.
Yeah, and not to dismiss politics in all of this too. So
of course.
I'll give you an example. Two examples, actually. One is that there's not been many African-American swimmers representing the US in the Olympics. I think like one or two off the top of my head.
If that.
Right? Is that because they're physically inferior? Right.
No.
No. Why is that? Because there's no communal pools or community pools in urban centers.
That's the reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Another example is when I think it was either an American president of the IOC or the International Swimming Federation. He was American. So he expanded the number of swimming events at the Olympics. Why is that the case? Because Americans have an unfair advantage in swimming. So in order to increase the number of gold medals that America won in the Olympics, he increased the number of swimming events. How many community swimming pools are there in Vietnam and Thailand versus America or Australia?
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's politics in this too, right?
Absolutely. And tennis is the same way. Yeah. Until the Serena, until the Williams sisters got onto the scene, there were hardly any black tennis players.
Arthur Ashe.
Say again?
Arthur Ashe? No?
I mean, do you consider...
Yeah, of course. What do you mean? He's African-American.
Very light-skinned African-American. I didn't even realize he was black, to be honest with you.
Really? No, Arthur Ashe Stadium, New York City?
What do I know? What do I know? Flashy? But there weren't. There's still not a whole lot of black players in the tennis world.
Well, yes, but there are increasingly more visible mixed-raced players and black players.
Yeah,
too. Yeah. I think the part of it is access to sports at the youth level, for example.
Right? But countering that, everyone has access to soccer at a youth, even at a poor lot. Like you can like you said in the beginning, you can just take a ball and kick it into a goal.
Yeah, so but to corporatize it takes a whole different.
Right. But I think there's separate streams of thought, right? I think on one hand you're talking about like local infrastructure, like facilities, like tennis courts, swimming pools. Yeah. Right, but soccer doesn't suffer from that. It's actually perfect for someone with no facilities and no resources.
Yeah.
Right?
So the thought about that is slightly different, right? So one is that yes, you can have a soccer ball and you can play in the streets. That's individual skill development, sure. And anyone can have access to that,
mm-hmm.
right? But when you're talking about professional football, it's playing football on a field. So you need the field in order to be able to understand the tactics and understand the position that you need to play, right? And that requires infrastructure.
Right.
And both in terms of facilities, but also infrastructure in terms of training.
Well, yeah, I think the training, the almost industrializing of it, the need to turn it into a full-time job, yeah. right? The ability to turn it into something that you do 8 hours or 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
It makes a huge difference because you're not just playing like a 3-hour pickup game on
and,
Saturday.
And like I said, in sports academies, football club, soccer, football academies would train kids in football, like the skills, the tactics, etc. But they would also educate the kids, right? Because they don't allow them to go to school sometimes, right? They live and eat and essentially work in the football academy. So they have private tutors to teach them and school stuff.
Yeah, and when you're getting that kind of attention to strategy, intense.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to beat them.
Yeah.
I mean, they're like groomed at 5 years old to
like
do
this. It's like a soccer conservatory. It's you're basically a monk. You're a soccer monk at that point. And you need to have the resources to cultivate that sort of culture. You have to have marketing. So you have to have branding.
Yeah, so you have to think media. About from a club, right? You're incurring all these expenses. Right. Where do the revenues come from? The revenues come from basically developing these players and selling them off to different clubs.
Sure.
Right. And so you need to be able to show to other clubs, either domestically or internationally, that these players can play. Right. So you need to showcase them and then you can sell them off.
And you need demand.
And that's why the international soccer competitions or football competitions are really important. So ASEAN, why is the ASEAN Federation's Cup or the ASEAN Mitsubishi Electric Cup important? Because they showcase talent so that those players are now worth more so they can be sold on to other clubs for money and then bring money to further develop youth, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I was very cautious about going into Southeast Asia dreams with this idea of football, because I think Phil and I know nothing about it, but I knew deep down inside me that there was analogous factors to football and to society.
Follow the money, Ken.
Absolutely.
Follow the money.
And I think in the beginning we couldn't find our rhythm in this discussion, now, but now we're fighting over the microphone. So this is a good sign. Yeah. I think that so many other things can be compared in the world to this idea of breeding players, breeding teams, breeding competitors to make it a corporatized, money-making world. And I think that when I think about Vietnam and Southeast Asia, I think we're just on the cusp of like explosion into bigger things. That might not be football.
Well, what's interesting, it sort of intersects with the title of the podcast, right? Because it's like the dream of being like a soccer star is fairly new, probably in Southeast Asia. Like, I don't think it was a channel or a possibility for a really long time.
No.
But now as it gets more corporatized and it turns into a bigger business, and there are stars emerging, right, from this win. Like, I think kids are looking up to these stars, like they become kind of messianic, and no pun intended. and they represent like a path or a life's goal or like an actual like something that's achievable, something aspirational.
Yeah, I mean, right? Wait, is this a good thing or a bad thing to you?
Well, I don't know, because we're not just analyzing soccer, we're analyzing like the birth of like any sort of the entertainment industry, anything that's effectively an ephemeral and entertainment based like industry, right?
Yeah.
That isn't necessary. It's not food, it's not housing, it's not survival, right? It's for pleasure.
But is it for pleasure?
Isn't arts necessary?
Yeah, that's what I'm gonna say. Sure, yeah, sure. This is what I was gonna say. Is it for pleasure, or is it truly like religion? And here's what I mean by that. A group of people are gathered in a stadium.
Sure.
And what are the things that we're getting from that? We're getting
opiates.
Sports
is opiate for the masses.
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
And religion is too, right? But what we're getting is this sort of unification, this ability to feel we're all one, and all the little things that we're learning on how these players get to where they are, those are the lessons that I'm receiving from the homily, the lecture. The players have all these like awesome like life stories. You know, they come out from the dirt and they rise.
Yeah.
Those are things that are uplifting. So when we're in the stadium, when we're in our church, we're watching this, it's more than food almost.
It's a big deal. It's important for cultural identification, for a sense of national pride, right?
Yeah.
For a sense of identity, of even like within an international context, I think soccer gives countries, gives players, and gives like people a feeling of identity and individuality. Like, people are obsessed with teams for this very reason.
I think it's also the significance of this win by Vietnam is that how often does Vietnam win anything?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right? How often does Thailand win anything? Right? I don't know if Vietnam won any medals at the Olympics.
Vietnam won a war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Right? Or several.
Several wars.
Right?
Too soon. I was just cracking jokes here. Yes. I think that Vietnam never wins anything. And I think for Vietnam to win. But okay, well, let's talk about, wait, but are you guys allowed to cheer for the Vietnam team that won? Because it's a different flag, man. We can talk about that, right? Or no, is it too sensitive?
No, that's an interesting question.
Who do you root for that? Do you root for it?
Yeah, what does it represent? Does it represent Vietnamese Americans or just Vietnam?
I think I would celebrate it from a Vietnamese cultural perspective. Like, we as a people, as a like a race, or what do you want to call it?
Okay, won something. Wherever you're from, Perth, Little Saigon, wherever you're from.
Yeah.
Are you going to go out in the street if they won the World Cup with the flag?
Which flag?
The red flag with the yellow star?
No, I tend not to wave flags. I'm actually not a flag-waving person.
What about you, Phil? That's a very politically correct way to answer something.
I don't know. I don't know that I'm... I mean, and a lot of Vietnamese people from Vietnam will probably disagree with this. Might even like want to fight me for saying this, but I'm not like... particularly excited that Vietnam beat Thailand. If Vietnam was up against like a European soccer team or like or an American soccer team.
You don't want to see Asian brother on Asian brother. That's
that kind of. I mean, it's like, I know Thailand's been more consistent and Vietnam's like the upstart.
He's into self-love.
Yeah. he's like, I don't want to hurt my cousin. But he's I don't beat my family.
Tide.
I'm not chomping at the bit to watch Thailand go down.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't take a lot of like a joy in seeing that happen. Although maybe there has been more of a fierce rivalry that I'm unaware of. That's been brewing for the last few years that someone else could speak better to.
You want to come under the thumb of these colonialists, Phil, is what I'm hearing from.
Well, yeah, he'd like to see. He said in the beginning, he said he'd love to see Vietnam beat Manchester.
Picture that. That would be insane.
That'd be insanity.
That would be insane, and that would be like that would be Jeremy Lin level. Every American would be tuning in and being like, "Whoa, we got this is what is going on."
Yeah, nine documentaries later.
You'd love to see that, but let me throw some realistic, reality-based fire on that. You know, water on that fire. All right,
here comes the party pooper. Here's
some facts for you. Manchester City is worth 1.38 billion euros. The highest value team that I can see in Southeast Asia is, what was it? Buranam United in the Thai League at 13.5 million euros.
That's like over 150 times.
1,000% difference.
It's crazy.
Yeah, I don't think.
And in Vietnam, the highest value team is worth 6 million euros.
6 million euro. Anybody can buy that.
Yeah. Man City is 1.3 billion euro.
Some of our friends can buy that. Some of our friends just bought a home that's worth that.
You've got some really interesting friends, Ken.
Those are your friends that you introduced me to.
But no,
those are Phil's friends.
Those are Phil's friends. But you know that's the for me from a realistic perspective. That's it, right?
Right. That's the scale we're looking at.
That's the Everest upon Everest upon Everest that we're looking at when you say that, hey, when will Vietnam get into the World Cup? I'll drop another fact for the viewers at home. Only one Southeast Asian country, quote unquote, has made it to the World Cup, which is the pinnacle of national football.
Well, only one Southeast Asian country ever made it.
And guess who it is?
Well, I already know. We talked over it, but it's Indonesia.
Party poopers, man. It's Indonesia. And they weren't even called Indonesia at the time. They were called the Dutch East India or Dutch East Indies, right? And this was in 1938.
Wow.
Right? So for the last, 80 years or so, no Southeast Asian country hasn't made it to the World Cup, and you can argue, and it's a bit of a dry argument about why that's the case, right? But one of the explanations is actually it's a very convoluted qualification process for a team from Southeast Asia, or a national team from Southeast Asia, to make it to the World Cup. It's like 8 or 9 different competitions within competitions, essentially, to be able to make it into the World Cup.
All right.
So is that a little like bureaucratic then? Like there's a lot of disqualification.
It is bureaucratic.
And technicality.
Yeah, and you need to ask why, right?
Yeah.
Because there are several layers. One is like FIFA decides how many spots, or FIFA decides how many teams play in the World Cup finals tournament. Right at the moment in 2026, it's expanded to, I think, 48 teams. So it's originally expanded from like 32 or 36. And then FIFA decides how many national teams are distributed according to the regions. So Africa, South America, North America, etc. So I think Asia's assigned 8 1/3 places. So then FIFA delegates who to the Asian Football Confederation, how they want to decide how to assign those, who gets those 8 spots, essentially. So the Asian AFC, the organizers, basically say, hey, we're going to have a tournament and blah, blah, blah. And it's going to be effectively an 8-layer tournament in order to qualify for these 8 spots.
All right. But I have another question.
It was very political in other words.
But when we think about like these pure nationalistic pride angles, we're thinking, you know, it's all Vietnamese, right? But they're not. Like the team, the Vietnam team that just beat Thailand, there were a lot of foreigners that were getting their citizenship like a few months before the actual tournament, the actual game. So all these countries all over the world are bringing in guys from all over the world to play on their national team.
Indonesia did the same thing.
Yeah. So
you could say Singapore also does
so that. Why as human beings are we so okay with rooting for our team, but then like these top guys are like from other countries? What's the sense in all this?
You mean recruitment, just in general?
Yeah, I mean, I can understand America. America is all about, you know, we're going to recruit different African players or Ecuadorian players to play in the NBA, and it's all good because we're here playing in the States, and it's states against states.
Well, yeah, even locally, when you see like a Galaxy soccer game, right?
Los Angeles Galaxy.
LAFC.
And LAFC.
Soccer game. Like, how many of the players are local to Los Angeles? Most of them have been brought in, I think,
from other countries. Yeah, so why are we okay with this, like, Vietnam, rah, hoorah, hoorah, hoorah? But they're like, I think the guys who scored those points were, like, not Vietnamese at all.
Who gets to identify themselves as Vietnamese?
I don't know. I think there needs to be a sense of some sort of identification nationally.
You've never lived in Vietnam.
But
these guys who have become naturalized have lived in Vietnam. They apply their trade in Vietnam. They work and live and work in Vietnam. They've got a greater claim to being Vietnamese than you do.
Sure thing. I would agree with you, and that's fair to push back, but...
Unless you're, you know, birthright citizenship.
Yeah, but what you're saying is funny, because it's like when someone gets recruited to, like, the Portland Trailblazers, and they live in Portland for, like, 6 months, and you're like, yeah, he's from Portland. Yeah. It's like, that doesn't really count. I mean, sure it does. Now that person's from Oregon, I guess, because they moved there to play on the Trailblazers. But it's clear they were recruited from like another area.
Then this construct of nationality, right?
Yeah. As
it relates to soccer, especially for soccer, construct,
you're asking
right?
a bigger question, though, because it applies to all professional sports.
Which is
like what? Like if teams are just cobbled together from... You know, from
foreign players essentially.
Yeah, from draft picks. Then, and it's all just like it's all people imported to represent a city. Then what?
Can we not use the word import? it's very non-humanistic.
Well, I think
these are people.
I think there is a non-humanistic aspect to recruitment. I think player, and this came up. This is a big controversy in the NBA. Like players, teams have owners. Players are traded. It's like the terminology
slavery.
The terminology is really, really fraught and really problematic. And a lot of sports fans feel
this way.
It
extends to college football too.
Yeah.
College systems.
Yeah. Yeah. But let's go back to this whole national identity issue.
One of the interesting tidbits is that there are some Southeast Asian countries that allow dual citizenship. And because of that, they can entice or have more foreign players on their roster, foreign-born players on their roster.
But let's take it to Southeast Asia. How is it that these like purely Thai countries, Cambodian countries, Vietnamese, how could they take pride in our country winning when the lead score guys are from South America?
Well,
that is a very nativist kind of perspective.
Playing devil's advocate.
Yeah. I've always wondered that.
A feeling of like nationalism and pride in a soccer team shouldn't be based on a pure race of soccer
or in person's skin color.
Right? Because,
okay, wait. Let me push back.
Immigration perspective.
Let me just push back. If I was Vietnamese, if I was born and raised in the country, I mean, when I think about like all the people who root for the country's team, but it's not the Vietnamese who are actually making scores, right? That is
racist, Ken. I'm gonna call you out on that one.
Listen, it's not a problem to me.
I think it's
not a problem. I'm just inquiring. I'm just curious about the construct of nationality. That's all I am.
What about the construct of a city? right? A city might be diverse. It might feature a bunch of people right. that are expatriates from other
but
areas.
But that's the that beauty. The beauty of the shared experience of, and we might get to the answer of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. By your questioning, we might get to the answer. What is amazing about being an Angeleno, right?
Yeah, sure.
It's like the temperature or the weather and the things that have happened to us, the fires and the sports and Dodgers just won. All of these things combined.
Dirty dogs
and the beauty of the people here and all the shared experience allows us to be New Yorkers, Angelenos, right?
Yeah. So some of the star members of the city, like some of the notable citizens, the heads of Congress, like they have diverse backgrounds and they're from other places and their families represent other areas of the world. So I guess you could argue that recruitment's just a microcosm of immigration and of the melting pot aspect of almost any city. If we need like pure Vietnamese blood in our lead soccer players, almost like saying the mayor has to be purely white.
This is Kevin, right? from Slytherin House.
I'm not advocating. I am certainly not advocating for that. I'm way too old to be advocating for that.
Well, but flipping the POV, if a team is purely just sort of fabricated, right, with big money allowing for like high level draft picks, like allowing me to cherry pick the best players in the world, right, who just come in, moonlight in
and smash everybody,
then that doesn't feel authentic to the pride counter, of a city.
So my counter to that is these guys live and ply their trade in Vietnam, and doing so for so many years allowed them to get Vietnamese citizenship.
And
they chose to get Vietnamese citizenship.
But I think Phil's saying the same thing, is basically when you can start to grow with the players, even though they're from another country, yeah. and you go through the suffering of losing, then yeah. you become one with the player because they've been playing for our team. So nationality becomes a shared experience. And that's what I'm getting at. Yeah. That's really what I'm getting at, is that this idea that We can root for that Argentinian player or Mexican player who's in playing for Portugal, but it's because year after year we're watching him get injured, we're watching him get devastated by loss, and then that one time he wins, we're all on board.
You're talking about tribalism, and tribalism is huge in football, right? You know, there's a saying that you don't choose your football club; the football club chooses you.
I didn't know that. Did you make that up, or is that real?
No, that's
Phil. Can you confirm that on ChatGPT?
It's very real. It's very real. Yeah. You talk to any Englishman, you talk to any German, the football club chooses you. You don't choose. So, for example, you grow up into a family that supports Arsenal, Liverpool, Manchester. You don't stray from that.
Hmm.
Right, because you grew up in the area. It's about that community identity
that
you buy into, that tribalism that you buy into.
This is what I can digest. This is digestible for me.
Yeah, but then having said that, though, there are players who are foreign born that go into a club that become legends at that club. So, for example, Eric Cantona, who's French, right, is now a legend at Manchester United, right? There's Lionel Messi, he's Argentinian, right, by birth, but he is synonymous with Barcelona, right?
And how long was he at Barcelona for?
He came over to Barcelona when he was like 10, 11.
Oh, wow. And just stayed in Barcelona.
Yeah. He was brought into their academy, into La Masia, right? And then he stayed there until it was maybe early 30s, I think.
You know, one thing that is not tribal is AI, and a new thing that came up is DeepSeek, and there's no tribalism in DeepSeek. I want to tease out.
What do you mean? What do you mean by that?
I don't know. Maybe there is. I don't know. But I want to tease out the next episode and jump into something that I don't know is absent of tribalism or filled with tribalism if you're looking at how it plunged the American stock market.
That's a very... The choice of language is very interesting. And very... for example, you know, when American companies or Western companies do something,
the language we use is kind of like, hey, they did this, that, in a positive light. But when you talk about Asian countries doing the same thing, it's they plundered. They did this, that, and the other. It's a very negative language. I find that very interesting. And we can talk about that next session.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. This was is good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them. Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Now taxes is 100% free when you file in the TurboTax app if you didn't file with us last year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, just do your own taxes in the app by 2/18.
What if I have lots of forms?
All good, all 100% free.
What if I had three jobs?
Still 100% free.
What if I once saw Bigfoot?
That has nothing to do with taxes, so still 100% free.
Now that's what I'm talking about.
Now this is taxes. See if you qualify in the TurboTax app. Excludes TurboTax Live, must start and file in app by 2/18.